Welcome to the EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference Podcast. The EDUCAUSE 2009 Annual Conference brought together the most influential IT decision makers and resources to improve the ability of higher education to achieve its mission. This podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. We feature a session from Philip J. Goldstein, ECAR Fellow for EDUCAUSE. His session is entitled IT Sourcing, From the Campus to the Cloud.
We chose the terminology here really carefully, and we picked alternative IT sourcing as the title of what we were studying deliberately. We recognize that the term outsourcing often brings with it baggage. We also recognize that the term outsourcing often means to people a very all-or-nothing proposition of I either run IT myself with a self-operated campus IT organization, or I hire a third party to run it for me, and that's traditionally how we've often thought about outsourcing. What we were interested in studying was something more nuanced than that. We wanted to recognize that the sourcing decision is one that IT leaders make potentially for every technology or service you provide at your institution, and that the range of choices and options you have beyond doing it yourself are growing, and they're growing in their complexity. Our definition, or the umbrella under which all of these options fit, you know, we called alternative IT sourcing, but we really were talking about decisions you make about not only when you do it yourself, but when you might go and collaborate with another institution to operate a service, or when you might adopt an open source technology, or when you might go to a public cloud solution such as, you know, Google Apps, or when you might go to a private cloud, which is the terminology that's emerging to describe things that are in concept like cloud computing solutions, but instead of being operated for anyone to use, they're operated and owned by a consortium. Could be a not-for-profit consortium, could be a group of institutions, et cetera. We also, you know, within our definition, captured things like the use of contract labor. One of our questions as we went about this research was to understand to what extent institutions were using contractors and consultants as sort of almost a permanent part of the workforce as another form of sourcing. So we wanted to kind of create a broad umbrella under which all of this fit under. And our motivation for doing this had a couple different components to it. In some ways, this was revisiting of a prior topic for ECAR. One of the very first ECAR studies was on outsourcing. And that study kind of concluded that as a community, there wasn't a lot of interest in complete outsourcing of IT, but that there were pockets of sourcing decisions or mini outsourcings that were occurring, like the use of application service providers. This was back in 2002. So in some ways, we were revisiting a topic we had not touched in quite a while. Another motivation is we wanted to create a baseline of understanding around cloud computing. And certainly, we've been following all of the conversation that has been going on around cloud computing. And we wanted to, you know, use this research as an opportunity to get an understanding of what are people doing today and what are they thinking about doing tomorrow. And then we were also interested in thinking about how some contextual factors that you are all grappling with are affecting your sourcing decisions. Obvious one amongst them is the financial crisis and the impact that that's had on everybody's budgets. We hypothesized had to have had an impact on your thinking about what you insource, what you outsource. But we were also wondering how things like sustainability and green IT were affecting decision-making about sourcing, or how some of the changing demographics of the workforce might be affecting some of the sourcing decisions you make. So there were a number of different things that led us to this topic. For those of you who are familiar with ECAR research, this followed a pretty similar methodology that most ECAR studies have followed. We did a quantitative survey, an online survey that was responded to by 372 institutions, primarily the senior most IT leader of the institution was the respondent. We complemented that with qualitative research, both interviews and case studies. Within our research construct, we not only were surveying broadly to understand what are you doing, but we also took some deeper dives into what's going on with email, what was going on, as I mentioned before, in terms of the use of contract labor. And we asked respondents to pick a sourcing decision they had either recently made or that they were familiar with that they thought was a representative case study of their institution's experience with IT sourcing or alternative sourcing, and to answer a set of questions we asked them about how they made the decision, what they learned, and what outcomes they were achieving. So that was sort of what we did and why we did it and how we went about it. I was thinking as I was preparing my talk, is if I had to tweet my talk, could I get my conclusions down to a small enough number of characters? And I failed miserably. I can't do it. I guess I'm not hip enough. But the recurring themes that came out of our findings, and I will illustrate these as we go, are, to me, these five things. The first is that there's a lot going on. A lot of people are doing things with cloud computing, alternative sourcing, but it's broad but shallow. So, you know, it's not the central strategy for anybody yet to kind of move IT into all of these alternative sourcing realms. The second headline to me was that of all the different things that could potentially drive institutions to be aggressive adopters of alternative sourcing, the strongest relationship that we found was between the leadership's outlook and perspective or preconceived notions about outsourcing and their adoption. So whether it's the institutional leadership or the IT leadership, those that were more inclined towards outsourcing in general were more aggressive adopters, sort of stands to reason. But, you know, I think what was noteworthy is we didn't find a lot of differences by Carnegie class, by size of institution, by how hard they felt they were being hit by the financial crisis. So some of the things that we predicted coming in would be determinants didn't really hold out as we got deeper into this. Third headline, no surprise probably to anyone who has been thinking about, especially cloud computing, the things that are hindering adoption in people's minds are their concerns about security of data, privacy of data, and how does that change? How does the risk change when we're talking about sourcing these to other institutions, other for-profit companies, and to the cloud? Despite that concern, you'll see that respondents expect to be doing more. It's not a revolutionary pace of adoption. It's an incremental pace of adoption, but they certainly expect to be doing more sourcing in the future. And finally, when you start to really peel back the layers and understand what is driving people to adopt alternative sourcing in any of its different forms, the things that really popped out to me are a quest for flexibility, flexibility in the use of resources, so that if I can hand this problem off to source company X to take care of for me, maybe I can redeploy some of my people to these other five problems that I've got to deal with that I can't imagine outsourcing. Or it's a path to remediate a deficiency that the institution saw in a particular technology or service. And again, above all the different reasons that people gave for what was driving a lot of their sourcing decisions, these were the themes that kept popping up. So we'll keep coming back to these as I walk you through some of the findings in more detail. The juxtaposition of these two charts sort of, to me, illustrates the phenomenon of broad but shallow adoption. So the pie chart are people's responses to the question of 11 different forms of alternative sourcing that we asked about, including multiple versions of cloud computing as well as more traditional site-based outsourcing. And we asked sort of, are you doing any of these? And you can see the overwhelming majority, the big red blob, the 84% said, sure, we're doing more than one of them. You know, we've got some software as a service going on our campus. We've got some contract labor that we're using. So, and in fact, of the 11 different things, I think the average number of things that people had adopted was somewhere between 5 and 7 different forms of alternative sourcing that they were using. And the smaller blue bar are the people that says, nope, you know, I do it all myself. I've got no external providers at all. I don't contract out anything. I don't use contract labor. So that's the breadth. But the shallowness kind of shows up in the other chart, which we asked institutions, you know, for these big families of technology, how extensively are you using alternative sourcing as part of your solution? And as you can see, the means range between over 1 to a little bit over 2, which is really, saying we use them for about a few aspects. The scale we gave people went from, you know, not at all to we use alternative sourcing for all aspects of this technology family. And so I think what this tells a story of is that, you know, there is a lot of experimentation going on with alternative sourcing, and there's a lot of targeted use of alternative sourcing, but this is not the bet the farm strategy for anybody yet. And in fact, probably, I think there were about was under 10% of institutions that even said that their explicit strategic direction is to use alternative sourcing as much as possible. And, you know, I don't say that in a negative way, you know, at all about the value of alternative sourcing. I just think that what the experience of our community so far has been is that it is appropriate for targeted opportunities. And it's not yet the central strategy for anyone, for, and maybe it won't ever become that. I had mentioned before that we had included in this 11 different forms of alternative sourcing that range from the ones that are typically thought of as cloud computing, and they're the ones I highlighted in yellow, so things like software as a service, cloud-based servers, cloud-based storage, cloud-based security, cloud-based development environments, and then more traditional things like third-party provided network designs, third-party operated help desks. And we picked this list. We were influenced both by what Core Data has been tracking over time, as well as what some of the literature about cloud computing has been including in its definition of cloud computing. And you can see that the percentage of institutions that are doing some forms of these things range from the high of software as a service, which almost half of the institutions who do any kind of outsourcing at all said that they have at least one example of using software as a service, kind of not very surprising, to some of the newer cloud-based ones where I guess if you're an optimist, you can say that, you know, nearly 10% of institutions who responded using cloud-based servers is great given how new the concept is. Or if you want to be more pessimistic, you can say, wow, it really just hasn't taken hold in a significant way yet. But, you know, this was the lay of the landscape that people gave us when we asked sort of, you know, what are you doing today? Part of what determined, we found, how aggressively respondents were adopting multiple forms of alternative sourcing was in part based on their perceptions of how ready the different forms are for adoption in higher education. And a couple of different things I want to point out about this. First, the scale here is an agree to disagree scale. So the higher the number, the greater the respondent agreed that a particular example of alternative sourcing was ready for adoption in higher education. And this includes both the opinion of people who do no outsourcing at all, as well as people who do some outsourcing. And what I found interesting is that the means didn't grew somewhat, but not significantly, just by crossing that threshold from no outsourcing to some outsourcing. So this isn't completely being skewed by people who just don't think any outsourcing is ready for higher education. The means were greater amongst those who had many forms of alternative sourcing that they were using. So again, a kind of logical conclusion here that the more ready you think this is for adoption, the more you're doing stuff today. A couple other things that jumped out at me was the enterprise software via the internet, which is really just another way of describing software as a service, got a relatively low mean in terms of its readiness, although on the prior slide I just told you that 50% of the institutions were doing something. And I guess I reconcile those two potentially conflicting facts this way. I think in terms of the way we asked the question, enterprise software, I think people were thinking maybe about their entire ERP suite or their entire student system, and were commenting on how ready they thought we were or our providers were to deliver all of that as software as a service, as opposed to a discrete piece of your enterprise application coming as a software as a service, where, you know, it appears half of the institutions that do any form of outsourcing are engaged in it. So I think that's why that got the lower readiness. And the one that got the lowest readiness, third-party management of all of institutional IT services, I think there, my guess is respondents were not commenting as much on the maturity of the offering of traditional complete outsourcing as much as they were commenting on how appropriate or how aligned they felt that solution was to higher education or higher education's interests. And, you know, whether you look in Core Data or past ECAR studies, it's a relatively small number of institutions that have made the decision to completely outsource, and I think that's reflected in the opinion that came through here. Another determinant of how aggressively institutions were adopting alternative sourcing was one I mentioned at the very beginning, and that was the executive outlook. So we kind of divided the world into those who were inclined towards outsourcing and those that were disinclined towards outsourcing of any kind. Within the IT realm, or we can even, I got the same results if you just looked at a question we asked about outsourcing in general. And we gave people sort of a range of options to choose from in terms of their point of view or their executive leadership's point of view about outsourcing. We ask people, do you view it as a strategic option, something that you do wherever you possibly can? Is it a tactical option, something you do on a targeted basis where it makes sense to you? And those were the people who said it's either strategic or tactical to my institution. We called them inclined towards outsourcing. Then we had another two buckets, people who said, I avoid it at all costs, or I use it on an exceptional basis only. And those were the ones we described as disinclined towards outsourcing. And as you can see, what this is charting is the number of areas that alternative sourcing was employed in today. And we had asked about 27 different technology or technology service areas that you could potentially use alternative sourcing. And you can see that, you know, if you go all the way out to the edge of the bar where I circled things, almost twice as many institutions that were inclined towards outsourcing are doing it in eight or more areas than those that are disinclined. So as you kind of look at the comparison between the two, you can see that those who had either the institutional comfort that comes from knowing that the executive leadership were predisposed to think of outsourcing as a positive alternative were more aggressive than those who felt that their either executive leadership within IT or within the whole institution were disinclined towards it. And I think that just both describes a risk-reward situation that decision makers need to face, that you know, whenever you're doing something new, you're taking on probably more risk if you're positioning yourself or your organization as an outlier within your institution, as opposed to just following what the culture of your institution is already used to doing. Another thing that influenced the degree to which institutions were using multiple forms of alternative sourcing and in multiple areas was, again, their preconceived notions about the benefits and risks involved in alternative sourcing. And, you know, so we asked everybody who responded to the survey, you know, give us your opinion. Do you think alternative IT sourcing and its adoption reduces your costs? Do you think it improves your service? And do you think it's risky? And as you can see, this is, again, an agree-disagree scale, that the means that we got, were... in disagreement that it reduced your costs, were fairly neutral to slight agreement that it improved service, and were slightly, again, above neutral that it was a risky thing to do. A couple of things, to step back and interpret here in terms of the data. First, this is asking everybody. So this includes that 16% on my very first pie chart that have self-operated everything. And so once you take, if you take them out of the equation, the means do go up for per people's perception of it, does it reduce costs and does it improve service. They don't go up dramatically, but they do go up in a statistically significant way. So some of what I think this is telling us is that there are some preconceived notions that people bring to the topic of adoption of alternative sourcing about whether it really can save you money and whether it really can improve your services. I think another thing that this points out is that this question was asked about alternative sourcing in aggregate. And as I observed at the very beginning of the talk, most institutions are using this in very targeted ways. So I wouldn't want you to take away from this the conclusion that institutions can never reduce their costs by adopting alternative sourcing or could never improve their service by adopting alternative sourcing. Rather, I think what it's saying is that this is not a panacea. This is something that, you know, the that people's experience suggests that you have to evaluate on a case-by-case basis and make a decision of, is this one of those cases where if I do a comparison between what it costs me to do it today and the service levels I can achieve today and what I can get in an outsourcing scenario, you will find some opportunities where it will save you money and you will find others where it may not. So I think looking at this in gross terms in some ways was a little bit misleading. I think another aspect of this, or another story that this tells to me, is I don't think we always start with a good understanding of what our baseline is when we're making assumptions about whether alternative sourcing is going to be saving us money or improving our service. And we're not always making apples-to-apples comparisons. And that even came through in some of the qualitative research we did about student email outsourcing. And, there wasn't quite equal numbers, but there were a group of people, and these were all people who had outsourced their student email. Some that we interviewed who really felt strongly it was saving them money. Some that we interviewed who felt strongly that it was the right thing to do for their institution to outsource, but it was actually costing them more money than it cost them to operate their legacy email system. And I think the way, again, to reconcile those two stories that we heard was to probably recognize that everybody was starting from a different baseline of what they were spending on their self-operated service before they outsourced. And I think it also points out a gap that maybe we all have as a community in having a standard way for evaluating the costs of something we self-operate and the costs of something that we could get from a third party. And some of the things that came out in our qualitative discussion around the student email specifically were, some institutions were including costs of integrating in the outsourced email to their identity management. Some weren't. Some were including lifecycle replacement costs of their hardware in their self-operated cost, but others weren't. So again, we weren't approaching this in an apples-to-apples way. So I just take this with a grain of salt. Don't conclude from this that I'm telling you here that alternative sourcing can't save you money or can't improve your services. Take it more as me saying that I think in targeted cases it can. You have to evaluate each one, and I think we all have work to do in just trying to understand how do we get to an apples-to-apples comparison, both in terms of cost and service. We went and tried to dig deeper into what is motivating people to adopt alternative sourcing. And this data that I'm showing you is from the use cases that we asked respondents to include in their survey. And so, again, this was a piece of the survey where we asked institutions, tell us about a recent sourcing decision you made where you actually adopted one of these alternative sourcing strategies that you're familiar with. And so, there's some bias here. Presumably people were telling us about ones that they felt worked out well. I think you can assume that there was, that kind of bias to it. But this is really asking them to rate the importance of a number of different goals to their decision to adopt alternative sourcing. And, if you can... You can see that, again, this is on a scale of no importance to very high importance. So the higher the number next to each row, the more important it was to the decision. And if you look at the things that really are at the top of the chart, there are things like I needed to improve service. I needed to get my staff in a position where they could focus on higher priorities. I needed to make my technology more reliable or bring it up to date. So I adopted alternative sourcing. These were my important goals. And this held pretty constant across the many different forms of alternative sourcing that we were asking about and the many different areas of alternative sourcing. And it really starts, again, to hone that story about this not being motivated so far for most institutions by cost savings, but rather by either a quest for flexibility, which I interpret as enabling my staff to focus on higher priorities, or a quest to remediate an issue that they had, and perhaps the institution determined that this was the fastest path or the most certain path to remediating a technology issue or a service issue. And as you can see, things like reducing IT costs were only of moderate importance. And that held true for all of the different ones except student email outsourcing, where it actually jumped up as a little bit higher priority. But for almost all the other ones, this list didn't change in terms of its rank ordering. Let's kind of look now a little bit towards the future and what the respondents think is going to be happening next. Across the board, institutions who are doing some outsourcing today expect that they'll be doing a little bit more in the next 3 years. And that was how we worded the question of how do you think your adoption will change over the next 3 years? While there were some institutions that said they might be doing a little bit less than they're doing, you can see the means were all three or above, which suggests it's either going to roughly stay the same or it's going to increase. The things at the top of the chart where people expect things to increase the most are the cloud computing forms of alternative sourcing. The things at the bottom where people expect it to be changing the least are the more traditional forms of sourcing, where people probably are at the point that makes sense for them and they don't really see that changing much. Just to give you a couple of additional data points to interpret some of the cloud adoption plans. Let me pull that out so I don't get it wrong. About 65% said that their use of software as a service was going to increase. 48% said their use of cloud storage would increase. 40% cloud servers would increase. 25% cloud-based software development environments would increase. So again, a general trajectory of we're going to be doing more in the cloud, but not a revolutionary pace of change. These weren't people saying, it's fours and fives. The majority were saying it's somewhere between three and four. I'm gonna be doing more than I'm doing today, but it's gonna grow at an incremental pace. The motivation for why people are doing it, I think we started to try to discern by asking them, how they think alternative sourcing will help their institution in the next 3 years. And again, this is an agree-disagree scale, so the higher the number, the stronger the agreement. And respondents agreed more strongly that their expanding use of alternative sourcing would be strategies they would use to help them access critical IT expertise or, again, build their technology capacity, so help them meet expectations or close the gap between expectations and what they're able to do today. Containing future IT costs was still at the bottom of the list. Interestingly, though, the more strongly you believed as a respondent that alternative sourcing would help you contain future IT costs, the more aggressive your responses were on that prior slide about how much more alternative sourcing you'll be adopting, especially in the cloud areas, over the next 3 years. And I think this is one of the places where the budget crisis that institutions are facing kind of showed up in our results that there were a segment of our respondents who were really thinking about alternative sourcing as part of their reaction to the budget cuts that they're facing. Another way to look at the contained future IT costs line is, if we start the story with people are using alternative sourcing in relatively modest ways today, and add to that story that they expect to use it more in the future, but not dramatically more, incrementally more, then even if their discrete uses of alternative sourcing saves them money, when you put that in the context of the entire IT budget, it's not going to have a dramatic impact until they get to some tipping point of adoption where more of their IT services and technologies are wrapped up in alternative sourcing to really move the needle dramatically on the budget as a whole, which is what this question was asking about. So I think that's sort of another way of interpreting, why containing future IT costs was lower relative to the other goals. I just mentioned this while I'm on the slide, as I recall it, the other thing that did have a strong association with aggressiveness of future adoption was how satisfied you were with your IT outcomes today. And we actually had asked that question thinking we would be testing whether more aggressive adoption of alternative sourcing got you any better IT outcomes, outcomes measured in terms of the reliability of your technology and the cost effectiveness of your technology. And again, we found no relationship between current adoption and those outcomes. But what we did find was a relationship that if you were dissatisfied, you were more likely to be an aggressive future adopter. And again, it fits in with that broader theme that I've been promoting of people are moving towards this in part because they're viewing it as a way to perhaps more quickly remediate issues that they've got in their technology or their technology services. And then again, what this chart is conveying is that the limitations that have been holding back adoption historically are anticipated to be the same issues that we'll be grappling with as you move ahead. So institutions, we were asking, tell us whether you agree or disagree that your adoption in the next 3 years will be limited by these factors. And you can see, again, top of the list, data security concerns. Number three on the list, regulatory compliance concerns, which I kind of read as FERPA and HIPAA, which is just another way of probably getting back to choice number one. I'm worried about data security. And so the things that have been holding people back in the past are things that are continuing to be on people's worry lists, even for those who are doing things and are planning to do more in the future. Let me share with you before we run out of time a little bit about what we learned about what's going on with email and what's going on with contract labor. I guess what you can see from these two pie charts, one that shows student email sourcing, the other faculty staff email sourcing, is the predominant way of hosting and provisioning email is still do-it-yourself. So the central IT organization is still the predominant host. But we're up to, at least of the population that we surveyed, a quarter that are using either a free or fee-based commercial host for their primary student email. The ones that are in the other category were either institutions that don't have a primary student email system, they probably have multiple student email systems, or institutions that said, my email's hosted by another institution, either in a public system some kind of collaboration that they've entered into. So that red wedge is not insignificant, and it's certainly in keeping with some of the other sources of data that I've looked at that's trying to capture what is right now a rapidly moving target about student email outsourcing. On the faculty staff side, a much more conservative picture. It was only 5% of the population that we surveyed that had outsourced their faculty and staff email. And I recognize this is a moving target too, and I know it's under consideration at an increasing number of campuses just from my own anecdotal conversations. And I'll show you data in a minute about what people said their plans for the future were with faculty and staff email. But what this data is looking at is outcomes that institutions who have outsourced their student email feel they're achieving. And so we asked people to rate the performance of their hosted student email along a number of different dimensions on a scale from poor to excellent. So the higher the number, the better the performance they think they're getting. And you can see that in terms of reliability, enabling staff to focus on higher priorities, again, back to that flexibility remediation theme, people feel like things are performing reasonably well. And in fact, actually across almost all of these, people feel that things are performing not exceptional, but reasonably well, somewhere in between good and very good where the means were. If you contrast or compare this with what people said were their primary motivations for outsourcing student email, the top three were to save money, enable IT staff to focus on higher priorities, or to enhance the capabilities of the email solution. And if you look at those areas as being the things that were most important to people when they outsourced, again, relatively good performance and satisfaction. Another interesting data point I included on the slide is, I know, again, through the interviews that we did, a lot of where the discussion often goes when you're talking about outsourcing student email is, what does it do for our ability to maintain official communications with students and know that students are getting our official communications? So we asked, for those who had outsourced, do you feel like your capability to know that, do you feel like the reliability of students' receipt of official communications has gotten better or worse, since you outsourced? And 40% agreed or strongly agreed that it had gotten better. The minority thought that in any way it had declined, and the overwhelming majority thought it was either, again, as good as it was in the past or even better than it was in the past. So far, so good for those who have done it. In terms of plans for where people think they'll go in with their faculty and staff email, we asked about intentions over the next 3 years to outsource. And you can see, again, the part of the pie chart I circled, it was about 20%, a fifth of the respondents who have not yet outsourced think that it's either likely or highly likely that they will outsource in the next 3 years. But there's also a much larger swath that still doesn't think they're going to go there. You know, this is always a difficult question to ask and interpret because 3 years is a pretty long time horizon and lots of things are going to change. You know, likeliness to do something is not the same as commitment. With those caveats in mind, I would say I would interpret this slide as it's a topic that's under active discussion, but there's not yet a groundswell of movement towards faculty and staff email outsourcing. And I think you could argue that we are approaching a groundswell of movement towards the student email outsourcing. On the both the student and staff email outsourcing, not a lot of difference in what people are doing and what they think they're going to do, certainly for faculty and staff email, by size of institution or Carnegie class. On the student email, we did see a little bit more prevalence in the use of commercial hosting of student email amongst community colleges and research universities, less frequently used by master's and bachelor's institutions. Last part I'll touch on before I try to wrap this all up is the contractors and consultants and their use. And here we try to, in our survey, define this carefully so that we were excluding people who were using contractors and consultants to accomplish short-term projects. So what we told people we were interested in is where are you using or how often are you using contractors and consultants on a regular basis to deliver a routine IT service? So what we're really trying to understand is to what extent are contractors and consultants a portion of the permanent IT workforce for respondents? And what we found is a slight majority of the respondents said we don't use them at all. Given that definition, we're not using any contractors or consultants. But 43% or so were saying, yeah, we do. We do use them we use them anywhere. They make up anywhere from 1 to the high end of the range was about 10% of our central IT workforce. And these are people that we routinely employ or regularly employ to deliver our routine services. A couple of different patterns that helped us understand why institutions were doing this or what kinds of institutions were more aggressively using contract labor. One, again, goes back to our shorthand way of thinking about whether it was an institutional culture and leadership team that was predisposed or disinclined towards outsourcing. So that's what the bar graph shows, in that among those institutions that were inclined towards outsourcing, more than half were aggressive users of contract labor, relatively aggressive, given that nobody was really getting over that 10% threshold, and that far fewer were users of contract labor if they were disinclined towards outsourcing. That's the 34%. So again, outlook and institutional culture appears to have a bearing on this. I think we can also start to get some clues to why people do it just by how they answered these questions about their perceptions of contract labor. And the way I interpret this is where we got the strong agreement on the top of the chart were for statements like, it's an effective way for me to plug a skill set gap that I can't get by hiring a person, or it's an effective way for me to accomplish projects. And it's, again, back to that flexibility theme. What it wasn't, if you look at the bottom two, was a repudiation of the quality of the institutional IT staff. So it wasn't people saying, I need to do this because I just get more productivity out of a contractor, or I get better skills out of a contractor than I could get out of a member of my own workforce. But again, more of this question of plugging holes and flexibility. Interestingly, for those who said they don't use contract labor at all, the predominant reasons, or the three most frequently cited reasons were, it would raise my IT costs, so it's too expensive for me to do it. Second most frequently cited reason was it's just it's against my institutional culture. It just, you know, wouldn't fit here, which kind of goes back to that inclined or disinclined towards outsourcing. And the third was, I can't find people. I'd like to do it, but I, for whatever reason, maybe tied to geography, the institution can't find qualified people to bring in this kind of contract form. Now, these questions were asked about a year ago with all of the layoffs that have gone on, not only in higher education, but across all industries. There's probably a different workforce out there ready to be contractors and consultants than there was a year ago. So that inability to find people may be a very different prospect today. The other factor, and again, I guess I'm hammering home again on the flexibility argument, the other difference we found between those who are using contractors and consultants a lot and those who aren't is whether achieving flexibility in the IT budget is a strategic goal or not. And for institutions, for respondents that told us, yes, it is. You know, one of my strategic goals is to try to gain more flexibility in my IT budget. They were using contractors and consultants in greater numbers than those who said it's not a strategic goal. In 2004, I did a study of IT funding for ECAR in general. At that point in time, we found that most institutions reported that their the fixed cost in their IT budget was approaching 80% or more. I can only imagine how high it is today after you've had any kind of discretionary pieces of your budget cut long ago. So this quest of trying to create any kind of flexibility, you know, I think is a very real one. And I suspect that if I re-asked this question again today, I would get a different answer. And in fact, there were hints of this in the qualitative research that we did when we were interviewing people who were more heavy adopters of contractors and consultants. I think they were a bit of a harbinger of what other institutions are going through, and that they were saying that, you know, they were at institutions that already had had a hiring and freeze in place for multiple years or multiple months, that they were seeing the basic direction that they were getting from the leadership of the institution was that, you know, we really can't take the risk of bringing on full-time people even if we are in a situation where that's still allowable. And so they were being driven more towards the contract workforce as a way of being able to keep the lights on even in a situation where they can't hire people. And I guess, you know, I think we have to watch what the long-range implications are of this. You know, in some ways, it's great to be able to use contractors and consultants because it does give you flexibility. But now we're talking about using them as a routine and embedded part of the workforce. And that's going to change the way you need to manage. It's going to change the way you source talent. It's going to change the dynamics between your institutional employees and your contract employees. I will say that in the full study, we mined our qualitative data quite a bit to provide anecdotes about what people are doing who are high users of contract labor to make it feel like a seamless workforce. And there are some good examples of success stories out there. Let me try to pull this all back together for you in terms of what I think it all means. I think we're still very much at the beginning of this story about alternative sourcing and certainly about cloud computing. I fully expect that a year later, adoption is higher. I suspect that the combination of the economic crisis and the maturing of the offerings of both cloud and non-cloud sourcing options has continued to move people along that incremental path of increased usage. But I also don't buy the sort of the Nicholas Carr argument that we're on the verge of a cloud-driven complete transformation of IT in the very near future. I think if it's going to happen at all, it's years away. I question whether it will happen to the extent that Carr is predicting. But even stepping back from that, I do believe that the cloud is important. I do believe it's going to change the way IT organizations operate and the decision-making you do about what you do yourself and what you source to the cloud. But I think I think we're going to get there incrementally. I don't think it's a complete transformation. I think private clouds are going to be a very valuable and important stepping stone to more aggressive use of cloud adoption because of those concerns we've got about data privacy and risk and some of the different ways that perhaps higher education looks at cloud sourcing as compared to other industries. So I do suspect we're going to see more and more examples of private clouds forming within public systems, within regional networking associations to offer services to institutions. I suspect that, as I was commenting on before, that contract labor presence in the workforce is here to stay, brought about by the economy and the changing demographics. I think the other thing I take away from this is that we need to have a much more nuanced conversation about risk and what we're really facing in terms of data privacy risks and operational risks of outsourcing. Because I think a lot of institutions are being pushed into looking at it as a, don't even consider it, it's too risky, where I think the conversation we need to be having is, what really is the incremental risk if I do it? And is that incremental risk being offset by a benefit? And I think this is a place maybe where CFOs and CIOs need to come together and come up with more ways of measuring the risk of outsourcing in a more discrete way so that we can make better decisions. I think if I leave you with sort of words of wisdom for your own organizations, know your costs. This as your sourcing options get more complex and your need to want to make an apples-to-apples decision about whether it's better to outsource or insource, you really have to have a good understanding of what your current costs are. And as you fight the budget wars and try to preserve the competencies in your organization, if I just look at this selfishly from the point of view of alternative sourcing and your readiness to participate in it, then I think the things you need to protect or enhance are negotiations and contract management skills within your organizations, problem-solving skills of a very different kind when you're trying to solve a technical problem that spans many providers. I think your technology for identity management and your know-how for integrating solutions across multiple providers is going to be at a premium in a cloud and alternative sourcing world. And I guess my final piece of advice is, even if you don't think your institution is going to be a very aggressive adopter of cloud technology, have a strategy and a conversation on your campus anyway. Because as my colleague Ron Yanosky points out in some of the writing that he's done, we're in a world now where users can become choosers. And the people who in the past just had to accept the services that IT offered the way IT wanted to offer them, well, now they can go to Amazon and get their server cycles. They can go to Google and get all their applications. If they don't like your admission system in the continuing ed school, they can go to Salesforce.com and use that. So we're in a world where users are choosers, and it would be better if those are being made as deliberate strategic decisions than accidental strategy. That's probably all we have time for. So thank you very much. Appreciate your listening.
This EDUCAUSE 2009 annual conference podcast is sponsored by Juniper Networks and Quest Communications International. Thanks for listening.